You know, I think especially the older I've gotten and the more records I put out, the less I criticize myself about how I come up with songs, and the more I just am grateful that I can do it at all.
Yeah.
Because I used to really get hung up on stuff like that. I'd get hung up on how long something took, or other things that I compared myself to, or peers that I compared myself, you know, standards that I was putting myself up against. And I just less and less and less and less and less and less of that. I'm just like, you know, I'm just building a body of work and I can do it however the fuck I want to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hello, and welcome to episode 43 of Attention Engineer. I'm Laura, and this is my podcast. Hi! Attention Engineer is my show where I share deep conversations with fellow artists about creativity, grit, and determination. My aim is to consistently remind you and remind myself that creativity really is for everyone, because it really is. Let's kick that inner critic where it hurts. I am just back home after 4 days away. Away. Out of my house. And in someone else's house. Yes. I drove all the way from Bristol to Suffolk last Friday to spend some time with my parents and my sister, having not seen them since January the 13th, 2020. It was surprisingly normal. After the initial, whoa, I'm hugging someone who isn't my husband bit, it was amazing how quickly things felt completely normal. In the house, anyway. Obviously, all precautions were taken while travelling. I did my first lateral flow test before I set off, and then another one when the first one didn't react to my sample. And I recently bought lots of really comfortable masks off an Etsy seller in a bid to leave the house more and start reintegrating into the world after a very, very hermity year and a bit. So it was a big deal to go so far, to spend some time with other people. It was a lovely weekend away, and I'm very thankful that we were all healthy enough to do that. I will be staying cautious and seeing how things go over the coming weeks and months, and I'm not ready to ditch masks or social distancing personally, but we have to do what we feel is right. It was lovely to get a glimpse of what life could be like again, and just to have a bit of hope makes such a difference, doesn't it? Stay safe, everyone. Back in the launchpad, I've now finished my 30-day digital reset, and I'm very reluctant to re-engage with all the digital bits and bobs. I feel so much better. Calmer, happier, more focused, less tired, less stressed. The intention was never to just have a 30-day break and then dive right back into my old behaviour anyway, so I'm taking a few days to figure out what my new rules are for all the platforms, to get the good bits from them and avoid the negative behaviour that those addictive technologies inspire in me. The ceaseless scrolling, the checking, the rechecking, the vicious cycle of Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to email and back again. And again. They're designed to do this to us, and I don't want to play anymore, so I'm figuring that out at the moment. I recently asked a question on Instagram stories. Oh, the irony. What's currently stopping you from embarking on your next creative project? Strangely, no one said Instagram. The overwhelmingly popular answer was time. It's the most valuable thing we have by far. So, what are we choosing to spend our most valuable resource on? This feels like a really good moment to say a massive thank you for choosing to spend some of your precious time listening to my podcast. I've been making this show for a year now, and I'm so glad I've persevered. Launching big projects is always risky, but I try to turn towards fear and resistance these days. If something scares me a bit, it's always worth exploring. Whether this is your first time listening to Attention Engineer or your 43rd, thank you so much. It's time now to introduce you to today's guest, and there's a bit of a story behind how I came across his solo work in the first place. If you own a copy of my new album Exotic Monsters on CD or vinyl, and you're someone who likes to read the thanks section, you might know that I dedicated that record to Amy Balmain. I think Amy first saw me play at Hope & Social's garden party in 2011, but I didn't meet her properly until 2012. I was making the single cover art for a song called In This Boat, and I wanted to make a paper boat out of maps, so I tweeted a request to see if anyone could help. Amy got in touch, and we arranged to meet at Victoria Station. She was travelling to work, I think, from Brighton, and was in a hurry, so we stood on the concourse for a few moments, surrounded by a whirl of commuters rushing past in all directions. A pocket of calm amongst the chaos. Amy pressed a big folder stuffed with yellow and blue nautical maps into my hands, smiled widely, and then was gone, lost in the crowd. When I got home and looked inside the folder, I was amazed to find nautical maps of Portland, which is where I'd taken the photographs of the lighthouse, Portland Bill, for the inner sleeve of my album Little Battles. So of course, I used that one to make the paper boat. Amy remained very supportive of my music over the years, her name often popping up on pledge campaigns and Bandcamp pre-orders. In 2018, she commissioned a cover song from me as part of the Brace for Impact pledge campaign. And when she sent through the name of the song and the artist, I was delighted to listen to something completely new to me. I find it far more fun to cover songs I don't already know. The song in question was Home by Lou Barlow from his 2005 album Emo. And I had a really fun day making my own version for Amy, and thanked her for introducing me to Lou's excellent solo work. She was really pleased with the cover, which made me very happy. And towards the end of 2019, when I was touring with Robin Ince, I got to enjoy a big, squeezy, smiley Amy hug at our show in Shoreham-by-Sea. If I'd known that would be the last time I saw her, I would have held on a little longer. Amy passed away at the end of summer 2020, and the world is a poorer place with her gone. It might not always feel like it, but we all have an effect on the people in our lives. And even though we only met a handful of times, she had a really big effect on me. And it always felt like a great compliment that she enjoyed my music. Knowing that she enjoyed Lou's music too, I just had to invite him to be a guest. After decades on the road and the never-ending hustle of life as an artist, Lou Barlow has tapped into a new confidence in the chaos. In 2021, the concept of balance feels particularly intimidating. Now more than ever, it's clear life isn't just levelling out a pair of responsibilities. Instead, we're chasing after a flock of different ideals with a butterfly net. On Barlow's new solo album, Reason to Live, he's come to an understanding of that swirl, rather than trying to contain it. After releasing albums with Sebado, Dinosaur Jr., The Folk Implosion, and under his own name, listeners may have felt they knew the construction of a Barlow song, even that they knew Barlow himself. People have this vision of me as this heartbroken, depressed guy, but this record feels so true to who I am, to this rich life I now have, full of people I love, he says. The songs culminated over the last 5 years to show that music has returned to its central comforting role in my life. Now I'm home. This one's for you, Amy. So just to get started, please could you introduce yourself to the people listening?
My name is Lou Barlow. I'm an American musician currently residing in Massachusetts, Greenfield, Massachusetts.
Very nice. I have only been to Boston, so I don't know where Greenfield is.
It's on the other end of the state in the farmlands and rolling hills.
That sounds lovely. That sounds really nice.
Some people like it.
Yes. We're speaking just a few days after the new Dinosaur Jr. album came out.
Yeah.
And a couple of weeks before your new solo album comes out.
Yeah.
As you well know. So how are you feeling about all of these things right at this moment?
Depressed.
Why is that?
I don't know. There's just something about when records come out and when I'm in the midst of it, it's like I get really excited. I mean, I love making records. It's the funnest. I mean, I love it, you know, just the being so immersed in something and then and tweaking it and becoming so proud of it, really. And then when you realize you're like in the midst of it being released into the world, it's like, I just know, I mean, it's like, there's just going to be things. I want to say this without seeming like a very negative person, because I'm not a really negative person. And right. I believe that's supported by the fact that I continue to be a musician and I love the process, but releasing something into the world is like I then have to sort of gird myself.
Yeah.
You know,
steal
like,
yourself.
You know, like I have to fortify myself for this, like for like this sort of inevitable disappointments and backlashes and then also just going, because that's also part of the process is that I put something out and then I have to realize what I didn't achieve with that and what I want to do next. next. So it's like it almost, so, and I sort of live in this like wonderful bubble until the point when a record is released where I'm like, this is it. And this is the sort of pinnacle of what I can do at this point. And this is my next offering to the world. And then, but then I have to go through and sort of just disassemble the whole thing and figure out what I didn't do right and figure out what I want to do right the next time around. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that I can actually fool myself or just be in the bubble and as long as I can. And actually this time the bubble has been lasting quite a long time because I'm very proud of both records. And I've been living with them for quite a while in this state of like pre-release. But now that it's coming down, you know, I'm like, I just feel this kind of like this sort of self-inflicted anguish kind of setting in. It's just, I was just complaining to my wife about like the sort of particulars of a Pitchfork review of my songs on the Dinosaur Jr. record. Mm. You know, I'm like, it's coming. I'm like, oh God, that one. I don't want to. When do I stop?
The reason I'm laughing. See, we're just meeting now, so you don't know about this. But I'm putting my fifth album out the week after your new solo album comes out. Right. The reason I'm laughing along, and my regular listeners will know why, is because basically I think I do this podcast to reassure myself that everyone else feels exactly the same way.
Okay.
And I'm not completely bonkers because I'm, you know, I don't get Pitchfork reviews, but I, you know, whatever reviews I do get, they're never quite worded right. And they never quite get it, obviously. And I think it's just a common thing. And it's not about control. For me, it's not about controlling what people write about what I make.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they like what I make, I try and think, well, the intention was good. They liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all those particulars, like you're saying. That's where I'm, you know, you might think I'm just this crazy woman far away in Bristol giggling at you. And why is she laughing at me? Oh, I'm just kind of like nodding and appreciating what you're saying very much. And it makes me feel better that, you know, 20, 30 years into your career, you're still feeling this way.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry, though.
Good. I'm glad some good things from it. I'm glad this. Yeah. I mean, it is important to actually hear that from other people.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
I love it when I read, when like some, you know, just absolutely, I mean, I love it when I see like really successful musicians like complaining about reviews or like battling with other bands, you know. I mean, I love it. I get so much like vicarious. I just get this such a, it's so hilarious to me because I always like, Jesus, you're huge. What's your problem?
Yes, exactly.
How can you possibly?
It's almost like we're all human and the same kind of things hurt us in the same kind of ways.
Right, and they just never stop. And then just no matter, you're just never quite sealed away enough. I mean, I don't know. You're always vulnerable.
Yes, of course.
That's what it is.
And if we weren't vulnerable, then I don't think we'd be writing songs. So it's that kind of thing, isn't it? The thick skin. I don't have a thick skin, and I know that that's not a bad thing because it means I can write music that means stuff to me and to other people. So
right.
It does mean, though, that like other things do hurt me. So,
yeah.
But it's interesting you talk about really successful musicians because that's how I think of you as being. Do you not see yourself as being like as successful as these other people you're talking about?
No.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm not talking about like accolades and reviews. Yeah. I'm just talking about just, you know, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I'm just talking about how my life, I'm just talking about my life.
Yeah.
The lifestyle that I'm attempting to support, the, you know, putting my kids through school, paying medical bills. I'm talking about really like, you know, I still in a lot of ways, I live on a razor's edge with what I do. And I just always have, and that's a lot of that is due to, you know, poor, just me being an idiot probably, but, or just making a lot of poor decisions as I went along, you know, both personal and business wise, but I don't want to get caught up in that. I also know that, I do think I'm successful and I'm very grateful for what I have. And I just wish I made some better decisions along the way. So I didn't feel quite as vulnerable as I do. You know, I just wish I was a little smarter.
I just do think, we're not going to dwell on it, but I do think it's useful for people to hear that just because you love a musician doesn't mean that they have all the money in the world and can do whatever they like. That's it. You know, everyone's a person.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like I still have so much I want to do as far as just like building my own studio and gear. And I still just work in such a basic way, and that I have so little at my disposal, like, you know, gear wise and stuff is just, it's my own fault. But there's some things, there's a lot that I'd like to do, which is great too. It's great to still have such, you know, such intense desires about what I want to get and what I want to do, you know.
Definitely. And you have very neatly segued into the thing I wanted to talk about, which was not just the new album, but you are well known for recording at home. Mm-hmm. And I record at home, and people like you recording from home and at home have really influenced me in doing that, because it shows that you don't have to have a shiny, shiny, posh studio recording of something to make it worth something to someone else, you know, as hopefully we all do know that. So I was just wondering, was the new album recorded at home as well, first of all?
My solo record, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually even the Dinosaur Jr. record was recorded in Jay's house, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the solo record, I did do it at home. But there was one song that I recorded on the road, mm-hmm. you know. but yeah, as far as I do the final mixing. I do have a studio in the area that I really, with a guy that I really trust that I've worked with for years, and I do mm-hmm. go in. I do take my sessions to him, and that's where I sort of finalize the project. But
yeah,
but you know, as far as the recording, yeah, for sure at home.
Yeah. And so I was talking to Juliana Hatfield last week for an episode, who is one of my absolute favorites. And we were talking about how having no limitations can be a bit of a problem. So she was saying that she hates GarageBand because she used to record on an 8-track, I think. Mm-hmm. And she was cool with that because the limitations are there. Mm-hmm. But with GarageBand or Logic or whatever you use, you can obviously have infinite tracks, infinite sound options, infinite everything. Mm-hmm. So do you have any ways to stay focused enough to finish songs and finish albums? Do you set yourself parameters or rules or anything like that?
Well, I work on Pro Tools LE, so it's this really basic mm-hmm. version of Pro Tools. I think I only have 16 tracks.
Okay.
So that's it. And I tried to acquaint myself with another digital audio workstation, and I couldn't do it. It was like learning another language. I know Pro Tools really well, or well enough to really do the basic thing. So because I can't figure out how to upgrade, and every time I try to upgrade, I mean, it's just because everything is all online now, and Adobe is, or what is it? What is, it's not Adobe. It's a, oh, what's the name? The name of the company, Avid, that owns Pro Tools, are a huge pain in the ass, and they're like incredibly, they are aggressively, you know, difficult for artists to work with unless you have a lot of, you know, resources at your disposal. So I work with an absolutely bare minimum Pro Tools,
yeah,
which is I like that. I like that. I like that I have that limitation. You know, I do like the limitation of having, you know, a 16 track limitation on what I do. But so what else was I saying? So you were saying, so as far as recording at home.
How do you stay focused enough to complete things? I mean, I know you've been doing it for a long time, so there is the repetition of it.
Well, for this new record, for instance, I composed the songs for a project a subscriber project. So I did a thing, mm-hmm. you know, through my record label where every month I came up with a new batch of songs, and this could be like archival releases, it could be anything I wanted. But I kind of put myself to the task of, like, every quarter, you know, every 3 months, one of these monthly installments would be new songs. So it had a very strict guideline as far as, like, I mean deadlines. I had to be like, you know, if I'm gonna do these like four new songs, they have to be done at the end of the month, you know. And because they have to then, you know, because it's going to be on cassette or it's going to be on like a, you know, on vinyl. So it has to be, and because of the way that all of these things, you know, making physical product is such a, you have to really plan these things out these days. And the turnover is pretty intense. So it takes a long time. It can be very drawn out. So I had to sort of play within those guidelines and those deadlines, and it was awesome. So like every quarter when I would come up, like, write, you know, four new songs or two new songs, I had a deadline. So that was great. So So I did a lot of things, like so much, like I did things like I used to do, you know, like, and I used cassettes a lot. I would do a mix because I do have that limitation of 16 tracks. Mm-hmm. I would like take a mix. I would record, you know, instrumentally, and then take those tracks and dump them onto like a cassette player. Right. I could get that feel of the cassette, which I'm so in love with still, you know, and I would take back from the cassette onto the Pro Tools. So then I would have a 2-track. I would then, you know, open myself up. I would then have 14 tracks in order to finish, you know, my vocals and whatever clank sort of clarity embellishments that I think need that kind of digital clarity. Mm-hmm. So I was able to work between the two, but then also with this deadline. So it was like, you can't sit there and tweak the most perfect. I mean, there's a very limited time to sit and tweak the most perfect vocal performance. And also, if you just bounce everything down to a 2-track cassette, it's like, no, you're not going to be tweaking those backing vocals now. And you're not going to be messing with that guitar because you put it onto cassette. And now it's like, now you've also thrown off the tempo and everything. So you can't tweak that stuff. So good luck. And I that's how I did this record. I did it like in that way. And it like, it, the immediacy of it, and then also just the feeling of like, that's what it is, man. Sorry. Like, I love that because it's like, because it really did make me just, because these digital ways of working can really, they do just make you, they can just make you just the ultimate like navel gazing sort of nitpicking quit, you know.
It makes you commitment phobic. In a way.
Yeah, it does.
Because like you can just record a clean guitar and go, I'll figure the sound out later.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, I feel like I need to get into the sonic world, like create the sonic world as I'm going, as I'm collaging, layering stuff up. Otherwise, I might not write the vocal that fits the song because the sound isn't there for the guitar yet and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a really cool way of doing it. Now is not the time for me to pick up my computer and walk around my little studio and show you my tape recorder, but it's in the corner.
Oh, you have a tape recorder?
Yeah, I got obsessed and bought some stuff off eBay last year.
What specifically did you buy? Reel to reel or
No, it's cassettes. It's a cassette tape recorder. Cool. Yeah. So it's got 2 decks and it's got really good ins and outs and stuff. So I could do exactly what you were describing. I did it in a song that didn't make it onto the new record, but might be on the next one.
Nice.
But I was going to ask you actually when you were talking about the tempo, because when you record the tape back in, it's just going to be like slightly out, isn't it? It's going to be whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool too. I think that sticking to like tempos all the time it's not very human. Although it can work really well.
No, I remember when I first started, you know, 10 years that I was working on Pro Tools and just be like, well, can't we just pitch something down? They're like, no, actually, like, why can't you? It's like, my God. I mean, to me, it takes away. I mean, we so often reference like, you know, older recordings and magic of even, you know, the 80s, 70s, but I'm like, so much of that has to do with these little things that aren't quite right, that aren't.
Yeah.
Directly on, and also just, and also the temperament, like how temperamental machines are, or these sort of like tape machines can be. And then also how, you know, especially the Beatles being the most obvious example of this, but I mean, they pitch control is a really big part of what really the atmospheres of those records, you know, the pitch, you know, altering the pitch of the tape machines between, you know, overdubs and mix downs and whatever is a large part of what we, you know, we recognize, you know, as listeners as being these sort of magical textures, you know.
Yeah, well, atmospherics is a really interesting word to use, because I think like the fact that anyone, and I think this is a good thing, but anyone could create very high quality sound into a computer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that atmosphere is not important anymore. And, you know, that's the magical part of it for me anyway.
Yeah.
Is hearing that a person made something, hearing the breath and hearing... like not big mistakes, but just like imperfections and stuff, because otherwise it kind of gives this impression that life is so perfect and I'm not perfect at all. So it doesn't fit with me very well.
Yeah.
I just love your description of how you made that record. It's even more interesting.
Cool. Awesome.
Good work. So staying on the subject of this brilliant new album of yours, the press release has a quote from you about music having a central comforting role in your life, which really resonates with me as well as a songwriter. Is that what the song In My Arms is about? Because it sounds like it kind of could be a love song, but to me it sounds like it's about music.
I, I realized yesterday, well, the music, the actual, I mean, the song is about, it's about my music.
Okay.
It's about my guitar practically. I mean, it's just like, it's about my guitar. It's about a tape machine. It's about a guitar and a tape machine. That's what it's about. And the song opens up, with, you know, a sample that, I mean, it's a sample of a cassette recording I did in like 1982, you know?
Wow.
And when I was first discovering my strumming styles and I was first, you know, layering things onto portable cassette recorders and then playing them back out through, you know, a larger cassette recorder through the speakers and then recording it back into the portable cassette recorder. And then how, when I did that sort of rudimentary multi-tracking that I did, you know, when I was, I mean, 1982, I was, you know, 14, 15, but when I did that, and that was my first, like, when I just got addicted to it, I guess you could say, or where I just really became very impressed with myself. You know, I was like, wow, I love that. I love the way that sounds. And I'm like, I don't know. And I would be like, I don't know of anything that sounds quite like that. Maybe I've, you know, maybe, you know, just me just with my, the sort of idiosyncratic way that I strum this like classical guitar that only has four strings on it. Like maybe this is something that, maybe this is this is my path forward, you know, this is my way to like my way in to this mysterious world, this mysterious and intimidating world of music. Maybe that's my way into it. And, and it was, but it's so funny. Like, you know, when we talk about digital, all these ways of recording, changing and evolving over the years and how it can really remove you from the process. It's like with this particular project, like I was like, I'm going back to the beginning and I'm going to find that spot. And In My Arms was the last song that I recorded for the record. And I was going, and I just basically, it's almost like a love song to the project. Mm. And it's like, it's a very, I also was thinking, cause I'm going to do a video for it. So I've been trying to think about what the song is about, like what images would work with it. What I'm, you know, I just, you know, what can I do to sort of, bring out the emotional part of the song. And I just had this realization. I was like, wow, I'm writing this about my music, you know, and I'm, it's one of the most blatant, like I don't know if I've ever had any lyrics that were so blatantly like self. I mean, just like, I'm just like, this is my gift, you know, this is like, what, there's a line like, what is this outrageous gift?
Yeah, I love that line.
In My Arms Again. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of like, that's really uncharacteristic of me to be so like boldly, but that's really what it is. Like when I heard that when I was, you know, 15 years old and still what I hear today, you know, when I do allow myself the time to go back and listen to things that I've done and sort of, you know, and immerse myself in my own, you know, output and my own history, like it's a really, you know, it's a very sad, you know, satisfying and very ego boosting. And for me, it's such a big part of like the foundations of me, just trying to, the basic foundation that kind of keeps me going and gives me the strength to kind of continue to move forward, you know?
Yeah. Well, I love that you put it at the beginning of the album as well, because it means that we can just get right into that feeling that you had at the end of the project and then kind of go through it as well with you.
Yeah. I thought about it, you know, I was able to think about it enough and able to like really kind of in the first time really ever to form almost like a concept around a record and the concept other than just like, you know, this is me and my feelings, you know, just more than that. It's like more than like, it's like, I don't, cause in a way, like, and the record isn't really, a lot of the lyrics on the record are pretty obtuse. I mean, I don't really know what I'm talking about. Some of the songs are incredibly personal. Some are very political, but it's like all of the, I just feel like I took the pressure off myself to be so like intensely autobiographical the whole time and make it more, you know, and then focus on textures too over, you know, anyway.
Yeah. When it comes to the meanings of your songs, then if they're not so autobiographical that it's obvious to you when you're writing them, does it ever happen that like 6 months later, a year later, 15, 20 years later, you realize what the song was really about?
Yeah.
Right. Cause that happens to me. And I just think, how did I not know myself enough to know that was what it was about?
I did this song once where I was just like, it's not on this record, but I thought, It's like, you know what? I'm going to be like one of those, I'm going to be like a Nashville songwriter. Cause they're always, they just write it, but they put themselves into a place of other people. This is what real writers do. They become characters. You know, this is what, yeah. This is Bob Dylan. These are what the real guys do. They put themselves, you know, the real men and women that write these songs, you know, they put themselves so I'm going to do that. I'm going to pretend that, you know,
be a proper songwriter.
Yeah. I'm going to be like, I'm going to be a Nashville writer for this one. And I'm like, I'm going to sing this song. I'm going to pretend I'm a guy with a girlfriend named Pearl, and I'm going to sing this song for Pearl, you know? And so I wrote this song, and I just really thought it was a completely contrived piece of, you know, songwriting. And then I recorded it, and then I realized it was like one of the most autobiographical things that I've ever done. In fact, it basically was a prediction of the arc of the next like five of what of this insane change that I had to go through. Mm. And it was actually like saying, probably what was the closest, I mean, the most like uncomfortable truth that I was living with was addressed in this song. And somehow it only came out when I thought I was like being somebody else. And I just, it was kind of shocking. You know.
So how do you explain that away to yourself, or do you?
I don't know.
You don't? Well, because sometimes I think about songs of mine that are like that, I suppose it's just my subconscious knowing things that it's trying to tell me. Like I know what's going on, obviously, because it wouldn't have come out like that. I don't think it's magic as such when a song comes out.
No.
So, I mean, it's magical, but it's not like, you know, someone else speaking through me. That's not how I feel. So. Right. It must be that I know more about myself than I give myself credit for, but it's sort of on another level that it's not quite up in the brain yet.
Right.
You know? So I feel like I can tell myself things about what's going to happen, but yeah, I should have just known. And then I feel like not a very good adult because I didn't figure it out a bit sooner, but it was in a song, basically.
It's another kind of thing.
I suppose it's just everything's in there, you know?
That's one really good thing about, you know, forcing yourself to be kind of quick sometimes and forcing yourself to like finish something, you know, without sitting, like spending a whole lot of time, like, you know, just gazing and picking at it, you know?
Yeah.
If you do it real quick like that, even in the, I mean, I've had many instances of that, like, well, that was really tossed off. I didn't like that at all. It's too bad. You know, it's like, but then, yeah, then much, you know, a bit later you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
it's good I did that. Good that I pushed myself.
Yeah. So do you write things quite quickly? Do you feel? Because I think people who aren't songwriters might look at, say, you know, a solo album comes out here, and then maybe 6 years later another solo album comes out, and then there's another gap. But it's not like in between you're working on that solo album the whole time, because you also have several other projects that you play in and write in.
Well, I mean, it's odd. I mean, there's songs, I don't know. I mean, it's all different. I mean, there's songs that on this record that there's another song called Over You on the record. It's based on a melody and sort of a lyrical nugget that I came up with in 1982. So that's like 92, 2002, 2012. It's almost 40 years old.
Wow.
I mean, and that song has been in my head that whole time. You know, it's been in my head in these different, and there's another song, it's called Clouded Age. That song I started writing that song in like 1997.
Yeah.
And it was just always in my head in some phase of completion until something just, you know, really kicked in. And I finished it in, you know, 2020. So but then there's other songs on the record that I wrote in 5 minutes. I mean, top to bottom, 5 minutes, you know. Nice. I mean, I don't.
Yeah. It's always a mix, isn't it?
It's a real mix. I mean, that's one, you know, I think especially the older I've gotten and the more records I put out, the less I criticize myself about how I come up with songs, and the more I just am grateful that I can do it at all. Because I used to really get hung up on stuff like that. You know, I'd get hung up on how long something took or something seeming tossed off. And I had a lot of standards on other things that I compared myself to, or peers that I compared myself, or things that I was always, you know, standards that I was putting myself up against. And I just less and less and less and less and less and less of that. So it's just, I'm just like, you know, I'm just building a body of work and I can do it however the fuck I want to.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so was that hard work or was that actual intentional work to stop comparing yourself to those people who were your people you would compare yourself to?
It was intentional, yeah, because it made me miserable. I mean, I think that's another thing too, is it could be a consequence of, you know, I'm a father and, you know, maybe the consequence of becoming a parent, a consequence of becoming older and not being able to, like, you know, drink as much as I used to, and not being able to smoke pot like I used to, maybe not, like, you know, not do all of these things that felt like really almost necessary or like challenging or like inciting my creativity, or I guess just the less that I do of those things and the more that I've just focused on the kind of pure joy I get from recording.
Yeah.
And just kind of, and, you know, and just, yeah, that's been, and it, so yeah, some of it is, it's like intentional, but I don't know how else to, it's like, I don't want to be a bitter guy.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun.
Really don't want to be that, you know, and I don't want to, you know, if I do get to a point, you know, where I'm more comfortable in my life, you know, like where I do have things that I want, you know, some little boxes that are checked off and some more security that I can bring to my family and myself. I hope that when I get to those points, I never want to look back with any kind of bitterness. And I don't know.
Yeah. I've been working on this. The reason I ask these questions is because obviously I'm interested for myself. So the last couple of years, I've definitely been trying to plan in more time for reflection and trying to spend more time off the computer and stuff. Mm-hmm. Of course, the pandemic has meant that jumping right back on the computer, it kind of gives me a free pass. So it's been a bit more of a struggle because there's obviously loads of benefits to that and to feeling connected. And none of this is in any judgy way to anyone else. It's just that I know that I'm more happy when I'm not looking at, you know, constant streams of information.
Yeah.
And so I find that when I'm away from that a bit more, you know, little things that are written somewhere or things I see online or whatever just mean so much less because there's so much more going on in my life, basically. Right. It's interesting to hear you say that obviously having a family has affected you in a positive way in that sense too, because obviously if there's more stuff going on, then music becomes, or the crappy parts of music or whatever become a smaller part of your life, don't they? They just become less of a big deal.
Yeah.
When there's children who need you, you know, that's much more important.
Yeah.
Obviously.
I know people who are musicians and stuff who don't. I mean, you can be a parent, and there's plenty of people who are parents who don't. still are in their own little zones and do whatever they want.
Yeah.
But it's been a slow process, to be perfectly honest. It's been very slow, and it's a real, like, it's all, you know, two steps forward, three steps back, four steps forward, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, like I'm always kind of disappointed in myself that I could, you know, but overall it's like it's just making records and stuff. It's a real bright spot. So.
Yeah. And you've made a fuckload of them, haven't you? Was it more than 20? A lot more than 20, I think. Do you even keep track? Is that something you, because I know you're talking about building a body of work, which I really respect. So I feel the same way about my stuff. Do you keep a track? Do you have like a number of albums you want to get to or a number of songs that's like, I've done it now. I've made 1,000 songs.
No.
No.
I don't think it matters.
No.
You know, I mean, I guess, I've never really thought that meant anything.
No.
Because it's just like, I mean, like, we're like, you're prolific. It's like, so what? Like, who cares? What does that mean? And like, the one thing I guess I think I have is like, I am on the quest for like an undeniably beautiful song, you know?
Right.
That's what I'm like. That's what I'm And it's always amazing how that standard just changes and evolves, you know, depending on what I listen to. Because I try to expose myself to all kinds of music that I've never heard. I really like it. You know, I love Spotify and stuff for that reason, you know. Mm-hmm. There's, you just have this wealth of just random shit you've never heard, whether it's from the past or right now, you know. So I just love how my idea of what's perfect is always evolving and always changing. And I do really like that. I don't have any real like sacred cows. You know, I love like Neil Young because he's so beautifully fallible and honest and so erratic, you know, and like in the way he switches between these extremes. And like he's kind of my guy as far as that goes, you mm-hmm. know, as far as like somebody who's just, I'm like, that's really, you know, and he said a lot of things that I really appreciate, you know, about the songwriting process. And but I don't know where I'm going with this, but
it doesn't matter. This is really interesting.
You know, I just love how I do really love, I mean, like my son, he's into music, but he's really into rap. So it's like, we're listening mm-hmm. to like a lot of new rap. And then, I'm playing him like old rap. So I'm finding that like now it's like rap is becoming like sort of re-entered my life. I mean, it's been in and out of my life, like as a pretty intense, you know, inspiration, just not so much like wanting to sound like it or ever mm-hmm. wanting rap or anything like that. But I think what I've always loved about rap is how it's the best of it. It always has like the most like interesting experimental recording techniques that are happening. It has mm-hmm. the most off the cuff, you know, like spontaneous things that are happening. It has like some of the most incredibly like insightful and like honest lyrics that are happening. And it also has like, you know, the opposite of that in all yeah. those ways too. That all just kind of happening at once. And that's my kind of cool lately is my son kind of, I wouldn't say forcing me back into the world of rap, but in a way kind of, because I wasn't really listening to a lot of rap. It just wasn't what I was listening to, but now he and I are like, we've got a little Spotify playlist that we work on together, you know, where like, should I, you know, we'll play things and be like, should we put that on our playlist, Dad? And I'm like, yeah.
That's so cute.
I've turned him on to Wu-Tang. Mm. And he turned me on to Biggie Smalls because I never listened to that. Mm-hmm. Then he plays anyway.
That's great that you can be influencing each other that way, because you've obviously got your, you know, all the bands that were so important to you that you can share with him, but he's going to bring you new stuff, obviously. That's cool.
I love the way kids process music, you know, I mean, I just, the way they listen to it, what they think is cool, like I mean, it's so interesting to me. Mm-hmm.
Are they into your stuff?
No.
Does that upset you?
I mean, I'm not going to play it for them. I don't want to sit and listen to myself with them.
No, fair enough.
I mean, occasionally, I'll get in the car, like when I'm listening to mixes or something. If I'm in the midst of a record, I'll be listening to mixes and stuff. And they'll get in the car, like, it's you? I'm like, yeah. That's me.
I was talking to someone recently who's got kids, and he was saying that it was funny because his kids couldn't understand how the thing he did around the house, which was just singing sort of silly songs to them, could also be his job. Because they sort of thought, but you just sing us nursery rhymes. That can't be your job. Like, that's not a real job, Daddy, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if they have any sort of idea that is a job, like being an artist is a job. Because, I mean, I grew up not surrounded by artists. I didn't know any.
Yeah.
So it took me a really long time to realize that is something you can do for a living, you know.
Oh, me too. Yeah, me too. Totally. I had some, you know, music lovers in my family, but but not really musicians.
Yeah.
And actually no real artists. Generally. So
Oh, that's interesting. So it is just making it up as we go along, isn't it? Somehow it's worked out. Okay.
I don't know. My little one's really funny. She's 5.
Okay.
And she's like, I don't know. She's like a songwriter. She's like, she's throwing like rhymes out all the time. She's trying to rhyme things. And she does, and she sings like, I feel like I kind of keep my creative life sort of under wraps, or I don't really, because it's such a self-involved thing and it's difficult. I mean, I do want to try to give as much as I can to my kids, you know. It's tough. I mean, God, it's tough to even, but I don't know. She's like, she's improvising like all the time and like really like funny little melodies and She knows to repeat things. She seems to understand sort of the rudiments of like verses and choruses, and just does these wonderful mashups of like, you know, just little bits of things that she hears off of TV shows, or like, you know, Taylor Swift songs, or like Kacey Musgrave songs. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see if that, how that goes with her, you know?
Yeah.
But it's always about that cusp. You reach that cusp of some time in your life. You can have all that music and love music or whatever, but you sort of have to get over the, like a bump at some point where you're like, I am now going to do this in front of other people, and I am now going to fail. I'm going to fail. I'm going to be embarrassed, and I'm just going to continue to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that can be very hard. I always feel sad as well. And like, I often hear about people who, well, people who've come to my shows and they're just kind of like, oh, I used to play guitar when I was a kid, but then I stopped. Or I used to draw when I was a kid, but then I stopped. And I think there's so much kind of repairing we need to do of ourselves when we become adults, and we have to, well, not have to, but we have the opportunity to kind of go back and find out how creative we were, but it was kind of punched out of us by life, or, you know, a parent not being encouraging, or teachers not being encouraging, or whatever, or not being able to get over that shyness at an earlier age. But there's creativity in everyone. You know, it's not a thing that only special people can do. So it seems to me like kids are full of that stuff. And then sometimes it just gets less and less as they get older, unfortunately. If you were going to suggest three pieces of your own work to get people into your, into the headspace of your musical world, what would they be?
There's a song called Certain Dance Circumstance that's on Spotify, whatever. It's a 4-track recording. I would recommend that one. I don't know why.
They need a reason?
No reason. Waltzing With Your Ego, which is a song by the Folk Implosion. And, Someone You Love by the Folk Implosion.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you so much for this conversation. It's been really interesting. I really appreciate you doing it.
Yeah, sorry about the internet.
No problem. Again. I'm generally sorry about the internet, but it can also be good. So thank you. Hope it goes wonderfully with all these new records.
I hope so too. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. I highly, highly recommend you go and listen to Lou's stunning new album, Reason to Live. And I've made a deluxe show notes page for this episode at penfriend.rocks/Lou with videos and links. If you're new here, do make sure you visit my website, penfriend.rocks, to pick up 2 free songs and receive thoughtful letters about art and music. My new album, Exotic Monsters, is out now, and you can find all the information on my website. If you're interested in listening to another episode of Attention Engineer after this, I recommend episode 14 with Sadie Dupuis and episode 37 with Ryan Miller. This podcast is an ad-free zone, but I do welcome sponsorship from listeners. So if you'd like to find out more about supporting the show, head to penfriend.rocks/podcast and click sponsor. Speaking of which, hugest thanks to my Correspondence Club for powering the making of this show and all my music. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with a mystery guest, so I hope to catch you then. Take care.